Hey, this is Gabriel Roth, and I'm the host of the Slate Serial Spoiler Special, the podcast that accompanies the second season of Serial, which debuted this week. Every week, Slate writer Katie Waldman and I will dig into the latest episode, parsing the latest developments, clues, hints, and ideas, hopefully getting us a little closer to the truth behind the case of Bo Bergdahl. So join us every week after Serial.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of December 21st, 2015. On this week's show, Dan Ingber will join us to talk about the movie Concussion and whether it's a force for good or a force for not so good in raising awareness of Albert Brooks's chops as a supporting actor and the NFL's lies and obfuscations about head injuries. We'll also discuss another less important pro football crisis, this one around officiating and whether anything should or can be done to make the refs better and more accountable. And Sports Illustrated's Tim Layden will be here to discuss the outrage in some stables that Serena Williams and not the horse American Pharoah was named SI's Sports Person of the Year. Was that our horse pun siren, or was that actually Mike?
It's our horse pun effect.
I know that was a weak horse pun, but I thought we were kind of build up some momentum.
From a trot to a gallop, I understand.
Yeah. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. I was going really slow to see if I could find a pun in one of those words, but I just lost it. Yeah. I couldn't do it. With us from New York, it's Mike Pesca, host of Slate's. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Give my credentials.
Horse lover?
No. I was going to say, dude.
Mike Pesca.
Stefan Fatsis, author of A Few Seconds of Paddock. Come on. It's right there. Guys. Yeah. I'm sorry to jump in and jockey for position. I'm just champing at the bit and ready to go. Horse pun!
The host of Slate's Daily Podcast, The Gist with Mike Pesca. I'm just really not on my punning game, so I'm glad that you've embraced the challenge.
Yeah.
So, Stefan, Sepp, he's barred from the sport for 8 years. Sepp Blatter, found guilty of ethics violations by the FIFA Ethics Committee, one of the stronger ethics committees within FIFA. I find this whole story very confusing because hasn't Blatter kind of left about 8 different times? Now he resigned, but he didn't actually resign. Mm-hmm. Now he was looking very ragged today. He had a bandage on his face.
A little puffy.
He described himself as a punching ball.
Oh, wait. I think Sepp has joined us in the studio.
Sepp, I'm sorry about the news today. What can you tell us?
No, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry that I'm still somewhere a punching ball. I'm sorry for me, how I tainted in this world of humanitarian qualities. Even suspended, I am president. I am not ashamed. I do not regret.
Thank you, Sepp. Should we move on to Whimsy Watch?
I always repeat, I'm a man of principles. These principles are never taking money you have, never earned, and pay your debts.
The kind of sad thing was that he just sounded totally incoherent today. It seems like Sepp is really losing his mojo.
He's pushing 80.
You know, Sepp has been described as a short, balding man who's getting a little paunch in the belly. But I think he needs to rebrand himself as the international BB-8. Everyone loves BB-8.
The horse awakens.
Listener, yes! In the home stretch, Josh goes to the whip.
Listener Jamie Kiesecker had a good whimsy watch. He pointed out that Josh Norman, the Panthers cornerback, had his imbroglio with Odell Beckham in that game. After the game, he does this interview where he talks about how Odell is a ballerina, a lot of kind of light sexism. And in the background, Jamie Kiesecker, our listener, notes that there's a Panthers teammate of Josh Norman who's trying to tie his tie and repeatedly failing for 2 minutes. That player has been identified as Teddy Williams, who came out of college. He didn't play football in college. You hear about guys who didn't play in high school. Yeah. This guy didn't even play in college. Wow. He was a sprinter. Didn't know how to tie a tie.
Right.
If he had been on the college football team, he would have had to have learned how to tie his tie.
Exactly.
Make them dress up on like game days, travel days, that sort of thing.
Right. Because the thing is, you just have to dress up two stations higher than your work uniform. So in football, it's fairly complex. Of course, you'd have to go with the suit. But since the sprinters just wear singlets and shorts, you know, actual anything with long sleeves is twice as dressed up. It's a greater leap forward, I think. It's a triple jump up.
On our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we'll revisit some of our recent discussions from this here podcast. I was thinking maybe we could talk Kobe, maybe Warriors, Panthers.
Yeah.
Well, we can.
Kobe's
we can
getting
discuss.
Better.
Sixers? I like it.
We can discuss.
Sixers are not getting better.
We can discuss what we will discuss when we discuss it. To hear this bonus segment and others like it on all sorts of Slate shows and on Hang Up and Listen, sign up, and you can get a free 2-week trial when you sign up, and that URL is slate.com/hangupplus. On Christmas Day, you can take your family to the local multiplex. Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight is opening. Will no doubt feature various parts of people getting blown off and exploding. Perhaps you'd like to see that movie where Leonardo DiCaprio may or may not, probably doesn't, but may or may not get raped by a bear. That one's opening on Christmas. And then there is the heartwarming Concussion, in which Dr. Ben Amalu, played by Will Smith, discovers chronic traumatic encephalopathy, tries to tell the world and pro football players before it's too late, while the NFL is trying to discredit him at every step and stalks his wife and gets his boss brought up on federal charges. Concussion is written and directed by Peter Landisman. It's based on a true story, which is Hollywood-y's for none of this really happened. Mm-hmm. Landisman says the movie is emotionally and spiritually accurate all the way through, which is code for the movie is not at all accurate at any part, any way through. We can debate all of this over the next 12 to 15 minutes. Maybe I'm being overly harsh about the accuracy. But after watching an advanced screener, I would also like to add that the movie is just terrible on its accuracy or no accuracy. And we can also discuss that. Maybe that's just me. Joining us now is our occasional football brain injury movie critic and Slate contributor Dan Ingber, who has a piece up on Slate about Concussion. Hello, Dan.
Hello. Did you know that Landisman also said that the equivalent of what's going on in football would be like it's 1491 and the world is still flat to a lot of people, including the NFL, and Will Smith, as Bennett Omalu, is Christopher Columbus? So I think we should discuss whether Bennett Omalu is or is not Christopher Columbus.
I think Bennett Amal is going to play Christopher Columbus in the Peter Landisman biopic.
Why would he say that Will Smith wants to subjugate the Native Americans? It's very odd.
We've got a lot of metaphorical ground to cover here. But I was surprised, Dan, seeing this movie, that I just couldn't really understand who the audience was for this. It doesn't really work. Even as it has kind of all the outlines and beats of an inspirational Hollywood story, just like the roles don't really seem to fit, and it just doesn't really work as an entertainment, along with just not really doing justice to the science part.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of a movie is weirdly straight out of Bennett Amalu's head, I think. He apparently was the one who had the idea to make a movie about himself. He went to Hollywood and said, you know, I've got this great story. This woman wrote an article about me in GQ. Let's do a movie. And then the whole movie is kind of just his version of what happened with other people who were working on the same, you know, looking at the same neuropathology were just kind of cut out of the film, this whole group at Boston University. And then the film also has this really strong Christian message, which I think is sort of true to Amalu's beliefs. And that made me wonder if maybe the studio was thinking this could be a Christian hit like The Blind Side.
Except football's so tied up to Christianity. So it would be a weird slice of the Christian going, the Christian moviegoer who also isn't a football fan. I mean, The Blind Side became a hit in Christian circles, but I think it embraced football.
There's a point in the movie where Albert Brooks, who's playing Cyril Wecht, Bennett Amalu's mentor and boss in Pittsburgh, he tells him, he's warning him what he's going up against. And he says, football owns a day of the week and it's Sunday and they took it over from the church. So there's this idea of, you know, they're alluding to the fact that the NFL is associated with America and Christianity. And then in the film, you know, Omalu ends up being even more American than football. He's a Nigerian guy who came to the U.S. and through hard work and, you know, and dead bodies discovered how what it really means to be a Christian, and I think what it really means to be a football fan. I think that's the move at the end of the film. So I think they're trying to have it both ways. I think they really are trying to capture that football-loving Christian audience and send this important and inspiring message about what it really means to be an American.
I mean, that was what was unusual about the film to me, too, is that it really was striving to be something that I don't think that the story generates or permits. I think this film wanted to be The Insider or Silkwood or Aaron Brockovich, but ultimately the dramatic tension of the big bad NFL doesn't equate to big tobacco, and Omalu doesn't equate to a whistleblower, because all of the dramatic narrative parts where Omalu feels threatened or pressured or his wife is being tailed by a mysterious car or the FBI bursts into the scene and brings down Cyril Wecht as payback for the NFL to go after Omalu doesn't add up. It just dramatically didn't add up. It wasn't compelling as a movie. No matter how much they shifted the facts of this story, it just wasn't very good storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, as I was on my way out of the theater, I heard two guys behind me talking about there's this scene where Omalu goes dancing with the woman who you know, will then become his wife. And it's just this interminable scene. It makes no sense why they even bother to put that in there. He's uncomfortable dancing. Anyway,
And those two guys were Paul Tagliabue and Elliot Pelman.
But I was reading the book that Jean Marie Laskus, who wrote the profile of Omalu that served as the basis for the movie, she wrote a book. And you know, the real Omalu loved dancing. He loved going out to clubs. I mean, that's just one tiny example of the way that the real-life Omalu is different from the screen Omalu. And as I continued to read, the real-life Omalu is consistently far more interesting than the screen Omalu.
But a little more complicated and less clean a hero.
Yeah, for sure. But even if you want to say, okay, let's make him a hero, the real-life Omalu has been, you know, had debilitating depression for his entire life. He almost dropped out of medical school in Nigeria. One of the reasons he has all of these degrees, they make a big point in the beginning of the film, how he has 6 or 7 different degrees, is because he's just kind of this depressed guy who's kind of, you know, he's just flopping around trying to figure out what he wants to do. I think that fits in with this idea of, you know, he's looking at these players whose lives have fallen apart, all of whom were depressed in some way and dealing with, you know, some kind of mental illness. That's interesting. There's an interesting story there. Plus the idea that he's, you know, he's Omalu is kind of a very ambitious, very smart fame seeker who's also out every night clubbing, sleeping with lots of women, but also deeply faithful. I mean, he's a complicated guy, and there could have been a good movie about a complicated hero.
Well, I think the movie has a couple of problems as you describe it. And one is the thinking is, and for years it was true, that stories, complex stories, aren't as interesting as people are. You know, there's that old Don Hewitt line that the flood was the event, but Noah was the story. So our movie makers tell these complicated events, and this isn't even an event, just a circumstance, I guess, through a person. Sometimes it fits and sometimes it doesn't. I think in the last, I don't know, decade or so, we've gotten so sophisticated we chafe against it. And that's why you see good, sophisticated filmmakers like Adam McKay, what he's doing with The Big Short, is not to pretend that there is one guy. There's similar movies, right? There was an event, there was a revelation, everything that we believed in or so much of what we believed in, it turned out to be untrue. And Dan, I hope you talk about the underlying facts. But to pretend that there was one guy who blew the whistle on the housing bubble would have been forcing reality to fit your narrative. they didn't do it with The Big Short. He came up with interesting ways to tell that story. They didn't come up with interesting ways to tell Concussion. And I think if you look at the track record of the writer, director, and even Will Smith in the last 10 years, I mean, obviously Will Smith, one of our great movie stars in history, but the stuff that he really gets behind is kind of like mushy-headed stuff like The Pursuit of Happiness and 7 Pounds and Focus, things with things that are ineffable and sort of mystical and, I don't know, not just meaty stuff I could get behind. And Landsman seems to have a track record of sometimes disregarding the truth in the favor of a cool narrative.
Emotional and spiritual truth.
Yeah.
Mike, you didn't even mention the legend of Bagger Vance, did you?
No.
All right, let's not mention the legend of Bagger Vance. Dan, let's talk about the science. What is the movie get right, if anything, and just quickly, what are some of the bullet points of what it gets wrong?
Well, I mean, I think the movie tells this, there is a sort of straightforward story here that the movie goes through, which is there's, you know, Mike Webster, Hall of Fame Pittsburgh Steeler, dies, and Bennett Omalu looks in his brain, and he finds something very unusual, this hyperphosphorylated tau proteins that, you know, are similar to what happens to some boxers. So that's all there. But then everything is kind of exaggerated. And I think the kind of allusions to big tobacco are important here because there's this idea that the powers that be are going to try to, you know, insert doubt into everything. They're going to try to complicate everything away so that we don't pay any attention. And the people who care about head injury are kind of forced into this position of having to, you know, overstate their case in every way. And this film does exactly that. So Omalu will say things like, when Terry Long dies in the film, he committed suicide by drinking antifreeze. Omalu says, you know, football gave him CTE, and CTE told his brain to drink a gallon of antifreeze or something like that. And this is, you know, a very extreme statement that the head injuries caused the neuropathology. That's almost certainly true. And then the neuropathology directly led to the suicide. So that's the message of the film. It's kind of like it reminded me of Jacob's Ladder or Blue Sunshine, these movies about these guys who are slowly going crazy. You know, it's almost like a zombie virus. So you're seeing these men fall apart.
I am Legend.
Yeah, exactly. You're seeing these men fall apart and they start forgetting things and they're like, hey, what's happening to me? And then they end up, you know, going crazy, smashing things in their houses and then killing themselves. That's this sort of a caricature of what happens, number one, and certainly a gross exaggeration of what's known about the effects of head injuries in football.
Beyond the head injury stuff, the major thesis in the movie is that football is bad for you. Football is terrible for you. It's all a huge lie being foisted upon us, which, by the way, is one reason I think the movie's not going to do well in the box office. I don't think America wants to hear that. And even if they didn't, it would have to be told so well to get some portion of the public not to see Star Wars. Anyway, putting that aside, I know that Engber is not a concussion denialist, maybe a concussion contextualist, whereas over the years, the conversations I've had, Stefan, put you sort of on the other side, where I sometimes have argued with you, where you will say things like, mm-hmm. Well, you know, football raises your chances of having list any of the mental impairments or Alzheimer's by 10, 15 times the percent of the population, which is true. Whereas Engber will argue things like, actually, if you look at, though, compare football players to their age cohort, football players have less suicide or as much depression, but live longer.
Yeah, one thing that drives me mm-hmm. crazy is just the way this is all summed up so often in this film and also just in media accounts of this issue is football is killing people. These men are dying. And that is just, I mean, to me, that's just not true.
Well, the men are dying.
Well, people die. But,
yes.
I mean, we have data and it's compared to big tobacco. We know what the relative risk of smoking is. It's something like in a given time period, you're 4 times more likely to die if you're a regular smoker. In football, the relative risk is less than 1. It's like 0.6, meaning you are less likely to die than age and race match controls if you're a football player. So we have the facts. These guys are not dying. That's not to say that they're not feeling any effects of the head trauma and all the other trauma that they experience as football players. But it's just, Like, it's just wrong to say that football players have shorter lifespans than the rest of us, or that we're watching these guys die in the field. It's just literally not true. And yet it's said so often, and it's, you know, I'll sometimes tweet about this, and that's, you know, there's no response. I get some people just disagreeing with me, but...
And the players believe it,
I disagree with you. I disagree with you because you use the word die.
Okay.
Logic would tell you that NFL players, on average, are... during their careers healthier than the population on average. And therefore, there's probably a high likelihood that NFL players, top specimens in the human race up and until the day they retire, are likely to have an advantage after they retire in muscle mass, body fat percentage, cardiovascular fitness. Yeah, they're going to live longer.
They're not
smokers.
But
that is absolutely – they're not smokers. As an argument, though, that has absolutely nothing to do with the fact – that they also sustain thousands and thousands of blows to the brain that may have a deleterious effect on their cognitive futures. And there are plenty of science that has demonstrated that that is the case. Some of it is anecdotal at this point. Some of it is really well established. And I think, Dan, it feels to me like you create the straw man, that there are these studies that say all these other factors indicate that, hey, playing in the NFL isn't so bad, and that we should consider chronic pain as something that is on par with brain injury. And you and I had this conversation on Slate a couple years ago, and I feel like our positions haven't changed very much, because I do think that there is plenty out there to say that this is bad, and we know it's bad. And we know that playing football can create serious cognitive problems for players, for people. And that, yeah, if you're in the NFL, you're making an adult decision to choose to do something. But, and this is a side conversation, but maybe we shouldn't be allowing children to do that because we really don't know what the effects are. So
it's okay for you guys to have different opinions.
Yes,
as the moderator of the show, I'm going to give you guys permission to not entirely agree. And I think, like, it's exactly like what Mike was saying. Like, I think both of you guys bring, like, an interesting perspective on the issue, and neither of you is wrong. And so kind of my question coming out of this movie is, maybe, Mike, you can answer this first. Does the fact that this movie exists, for as bad as I think we all think that it is in terms of getting science wrong and just for not being a good movie, just not being interesting, not being entertaining, mm-hmm. is it still a good thing that it exists? And should people watch it? Like, if people who are just the average kind of NFL fan, would they be better off seeing this movie?
No, I think it's a bad thing that it exists. I think it allows the NFL to say, yeah, all these people raising the issues of concussion, well, have you looked at the fact check of the movie? They could hold this movie up as a giant... Mm-hmm. Not a giant lie, but really skirting the truth here and there. And it obscures some of the actual issues with concussions. And I think it's, I agree, it's not only fine that Engber and Fats disagree. Why wouldn't they disagree? They're actually talking about, they have different values here. Engber is talking about the actual overall cohort might be better off. Stefan is saying a large percentage of that cohort is in terrible shape. The analogy I was thinking of is like drug kingpins. Overall, they're probably have better, richer lives than, you know, Mexicans of their age, but a large percentage of them will die a very horrible, violent death. But I think that to do this, this is bad. I do think it's bad in practical terms. A part of me wonders if it really will be anything other than a talking point, like if actual minds will change. But it is so antithetical to how I fit my own values, which are you have to really be truthful. You have to really be careful. Like, it's wrong to win an argument if your facts and your the points that you're arguing along the way are misleading. The old ends justify the means. I don't think with an argument like that, you should be as uncareful as this movie is.
Can I just point out, you said a large percentage of them will have these terrible problems. I assume you meant cognitive problems.
Yeah.
That's just not true. A large percentage of them
don't. A much larger percentage.
Some of them will.
Some
of them we need to agree on. Some of them will. A larger percentage than the general population.
A larger, yes.
Which is
more, yes, disproportionately large, but it is still a small percentage. A large percentage of them will suffer from arthritis and chronic pain. I mean, that's most football players, and many of them will end up addicted to painkillers. That's most football players. Mm-hmm. And then there are some. Big problem, but it's still a small total number. Anyway, I think, you know, to some extent, yes, I will plead guilty to this straw man that that you know people are.
Wow, he admitted it.
Yes. Stop the tape. Make a movie about it. Make a movie.
But I, Dan, I'm sorry. We're going to have to let you go.
Get Lanzmann on line three.
But I, in my piece, I quote, you know, there. I think it was Sports Illustrated. Someone organized a screening of Concussion for former NFL players. And there were these a bunch of articles that came out of that about these guys who are just, you know, sobbing. And they're, you know, they're it's like they're having sort of PTSD attacks. And one of them says, you know, he's crying. It's Keith McCants, formerly of Tennessee. And he says, if I had known I was killing people, I never would have put on that jersey. And this is just melodrama. I mean, it's just not true. And then, you know, that's, I think that is, that idea is genuinely out there, that this is directly killing people. And it is an exaggeration. And I think that at this point, okay, I may have, where I think I've softened my position since, Stefan, since the last time you and I debated this, is I think that back, you know, all the way back in 2009, I think it probably was valuable in the big picture for the media to be exaggerating these accounts of player suicides and attributing them without any real skepticism or paying attention to the facts to the football. It was that exaggeration that pushed the NFL to cave in and start taking this a little bit more seriously. We can argue whether they actually take it seriously now, but more seriously than they did before. So that's good. But I feel like, okay, fine. We've had that kind of, you know, correction. That's now there's serious research being done. I think now it's time to stop exaggerating and to let go of this sort of suicide claim, to let go of the idea that, you know, as Mike was saying, you know, so many in casual speech about this, people just assume that most football players are, you know, going crazy or losing their minds, and it's just not true. And there are
all right, Steph. Yeah, Stefan wants to have one final thought here.
I just don't see. I just don't see the media exaggeration part. I think that these are fair stories to tell. I'm part of an email group that includes a few former NFL players, and one of them wrote last week, I've seen my brain through multiple scan applications, and it's fucked. If it wasn't for Omalu, I would never have understood why I was doing crazy, out-of-true-character things that nearly cost me my life and, more important, my family. Now, Dan, you could argue that that might not explain why he was doing out-of-character things that nearly cost him his life. On the other hand, the existence of this storytelling and this reporting, more to the point, by people like the Fanaru brothers and Alan Schwartz in the New York Times originally, have done a service to raise awareness and let people know when they see Odell Beckham Jr. flying through the air like a missile and directing the crown of his helmet at Josh Norman's head, that's a dangerous act. And football people knew that was a dangerous act 100 years ago. But for the general public to know that, I think is important. I think you're both right, though. The problem with a movie like Concussion is that it turns it into a false melodramatic narrative.
Concussion.
The real melodrama is enough.
Concussion. Go see it Christmas Day. Go see Concussion on Christmas Day. Read Dan Ingber's article in Slate. Dan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Give the gift of Slate Plus to another Slate fan in your life, and they'll receive all the benefits of membership. Ad-free podcasts, bonus podcast segments, access to our ambitious multi-part Slate Academies, and so much more. No wrapping required. Give Slate Plus today. Visit slate.com/giveplus. Stefan, you just mentioned the Josh Norman Odell Beckham Jr. What did we settle on? Imbroglio?
Fufara.
Fufara. We've got to use Fufara more. Get that into the conversation. They're attacking each other all game, and Beckham made like a kind of 10-yard head start sprint directly helmet to helmet into Norman's head and was not ejected from the game. Seemed pretty clear to everyone who was watching that should have happened. Pro Football Talk says a league source believes that he should have been ejected, most likely is that he'll get a one-game suspension. Adam Schefter, who's generally not known as being highly critical of NFL brass, tweeted on Monday morning, for as tough a season as NFL officials have had, they have not had a worse game than Panthers-Giants. Bad calls, lost control, just awful. It does seem like this year there's been just a louder conversation about the NFL officiating being bad. There was a game between the Jaguars and the Ravens where the wrong team won. The Jaguars won the game. And it would have obviously been a much bigger deal if those teams had, you know, games of any consequence this year. They're both going to miss the playoffs most likely. So, Mike, we could go on and list all manner of calls this year. Catch rules, was the guy out of bounds? But do you think that it's accurate that the refereeing has gotten worse, or that the tenor of a conversation around refereeing has changed somehow?
Well, here's what I think. But first, let's bring in Mike Pereira to tell us what we should think. This is it might be true, but we have no way to evaluate this. So just on a lark, I started watching old Super Bowls, and it's crazy. It's crazy for all the reasons you think it should be crazy, but there were no replays, and when they were, they didn't show anything. So just the amount of technology, how clear it is, the number of replays we have, and then, of course, with replays going to the booth, it means the play is stopped so often, and we just love the forensic videography that is the NFL. And I think it's even bigger than we love to get calls right in football. I mean, my theory is that there's so much in life that the right or wrong doesn't apply to. Like, whatever your political persuasion is, you definitely think that either Donald Trump lies with impunity or Hillary Clinton lies with impunity, or they all do. So it's nice to have this one area where we tell ourselves that the right thing is always done. But this leads to such scrutiny that it's inevitable that it will seem like the refereeing is worse than it's ever been. There have been a couple, you know, NFL admits, NFL vice president of officiating, Dean Blandino admits that that phrase has been in a lot of headlines. But isn't that kind of a positive thing, you know? They would just, in the past, obfuscate or talk about what the definition of catch is. So my take is I have no idea if the officiating is worse, and we have no real basis, or we have no way to ever judge if it's worse, because there is so many more intense camera angles that could never lead us to conclude that it's better, but can only lead us to conclude that it's worse.
Well, we know what the NFL claims the error rate is. Adam Kilgore had a piece in the Washington Post where Dean Blandino admitted that the officials had committed 4.5 mistakes per game over the course of 160 plays in a typical NFL game. And he said that that rate had remained steady in the past 10 or 15 years. And so we just have to take his word for it. I agree with Mike that there's no way that could be correct, just because we have so much more information now in terms of, you know, pixels on the screen. Like, we can tell whether something's a mistake, whereas before it would have, you know, been in the realm of, like, who the hell knows. I mean, also there's, like, Twitter and stuff, which just amplifies every mistake, and people get just so angry and egg each other on to talk about bad
the forensic pathology is far more sophisticated than it's ever been. And there's no getting around the fact that fans are empowered by that to draw conclusions instantly. The refs suck. That play was wrong. This rule was misapplied. Everyone is a rule book. Doesn't help that the NFL's rule book gets more obfuscating and dense and complex, so that we are at the point, Mike, where we can't really clearly articulate what a catch is, something so fundamental to the sport. But what do we know? We do know some other journalistic facts, some evidence that maybe there is reason to believe that officiating is worse. And one of those facts is that there's been far more turnover in the officiating corps in the NFL, and that there are more younger officials, 1 and 2 years of experience on NFL crews, than there have been at any time in the league, at least since they kept track of this stuff, I guess.
And the NFL says that the crew, you know, refs were getting old and they need to replace them with new
who can
talent.
Run faster because the players are so fast and so strong, and can see better because the players are so fast and everything moves so quickly.
Just get Brock Osweiler to become an NFL referee. 6'8", kind of mobile. There's our solution.
I don't know if he's fast enough, though.
Yeah.
So Richard Sherman put forward the Seahawks cornerback on the MMQB four ideas for how to fix NFL officiating. I'm going to get to his first idea last, but the last three were: add an eighth official, just more eyes out on the field, reconfigure the positions. And I think this makes sense, that the two kind of biggest calls that refs can make are offensive and defensive pass interference, because that's a spot foul. And so if you call that, that's like a 40-yard penalty that can have a huge effect on the game. And so he wants the refs to be in a better position to make those calls, just put them in the defensive secondary. And then he says improve communication between players and officials, which is just kind of self-serving and we don't care about. I don't care if they tell Richard Sherman what's going on. But his number one thing is simplify the rules, which is kind of what you were saying, Stefan. But this strikes me as like a Carly Fiorina-esque, like we're going to get the tax code down to 3 pages. Mm-hmm. It's a total fantasy. And I think everyone says it like, you know, the catch rule is too complicated or we need to cut the rule book in half. But I want specific policy proposals from each member of the Legion of Boom about exactly how we're going to do that, how we're going to get it through the competition committee, and what those changes would look like.
Also, these changes really sunk compact stock back in the 90s.
I'm getting demagogued to by a member of the All-Pro team, and I don't like it. No, but seriously, I think that just saying that the rule book needs to be simplified, that seems like a canard to me. I mean, is that something that can just be easily done with the stroke of a pen?
I don't think it can. I mean, I think that the trend with something like this, it's like not to make a Scrabble analogy, but we don't take words out of the Scrabble dictionary. We add words to the Scrabble dictionary. And the more complicated, the more you add to the NFL rulebook, the more you create the appearance of specificity and finality and truth.
We'll make the catch rule more simpler and easier to understand by making it more complicated and harder to understand.
Where have I read that? What historical novel touched on that? I don't know.
But so many of the mistakes are not because of complicated rules. They just miss a penalty, right? They blow a call. It's not like no one knows what the rule is. It's like, oh, we thought it was interference, but it wasn't.
Right. And the like missing the false start call and the Jaguars-Ravens game. I think there are different categories of frustration that fans have that all get lumped into the refs suck. One of them is like, this call was obvious. Everyone knows what it should have been, and they made the wrong call. They were standing right there. How could they have made the wrong call? The other one is, we don't know what a catch is. What's a catch? You know, he caught it, but then they said it wasn't a catch. And people just everybody says like, refereeing is bad. And those two are just complete opposite complaints.
But we have the ability. And we have the technology. We are now so accustomed to the sense of absolute certainty that, you know, Bill Belichick is kind of right. Make it all reviewable. If we've got the technology and we've got someone watching every second of every game at NFL headquarters, why not allow them to make more determinations? Why not allow them to be consulted more frequently? And that's what's going to happen. Dean Blandino announced that the NFL is going to involve him personally, starting with the playoffs. They'll be able to consult with the league office to help make calls.
Floating in a blimp above every playoff stadium with a telescope.
As with the calls to take regulations off the books, I like good regulations, not less regulations. So if you go through the list of games where there's been such an outcry over the refereeing, so what's the regulation you take off the book to make the Odell Beckham series of fistfights on Sunday night a penalty or not a penalty? And when the Chargers kick off to the Steelers and the clock operator lets 18 seconds off the clock, what's the rule that do you just underline the rule to say the clock shouldn't have started? Everyone thinks the clock should have started. So what's the rule you take off the books? Or what about when this is a rule they didn't know, that Lions game when that ball was batted out the back of the end zone, right? Early in the season.
Right.
So that was one the refs didn't know. But if you take a rule off the books, it wouldn't have been a penalty because you can't say the refs didn't know it because, hey, it's not a penalty. But we want that to be a penalty. People weren't saying afterwards that shouldn't be a penalty, or maybe some were. But you have that debate if it should be a penalty. At what point do you say, well, we all think it should be a penalty, but that would lead to one more penalty. So let's just have it not be a penalty because we have a rule cap at 1,200. Taking the rules off the books is stupid.
Well, I think there should be a pause for, you know, 30 seconds between each play for the referee to, you know, get a Microsoft Surface tablet.
Which we still call an iPad on the broadcast.
And there should be a Twitter list that the referee consults mm-hmm. of, you know, a council of wise fans.
Or t- yeah,
and
top.
The fans will tell them whether the call was bad.
TFDOT, top referee doubters on Twitter. Could I just want to throw one thing out there. You know how so many things associated with sports, people will say, you know, I do it for free. And yeah, people play baseball recreationally. I think the institution of the guy, so Mike Pereira with the NFL and the other networks have their own ex-ref to explain what a horse collar is. And they have Steve Javy with the NBA. ESPN hired him to be the, you know, Pereira equivalent with the NBA. It strikes me as if the pay isn't good, I don't understand why the guys would do this job. This seems like such a terrible job. Hey, Mike Pereira, you're in New York. Tell me what a horse collar is. I guess you get to be on TV. But don't you think most rational people want to say, you know what, I retire for a reason. I don't want to have to define horse collar to you again.
You know what? The pay was so bad being a referee that they need to do the consulting gig after they retire.
Yes, and that's part of the revolving referee door. Yes.
And that's part of the problem, right? The referees in the NFL are not full-time employees. They are school principals and lawyers, and they get on a plane on Saturday and go ref a game on Sunday.
They should live in the stadium.
Whoa. NFL referees earn an average of close to $200,000 in pay. They're doing well.
Yeah. All right. So we've solved that problem. Let's move along to making our holiday shopping easier with the Slate gift guide.
Wow.
A curated collection of products selected by Slate editors and writers. These are the things that most improved our lives this year, wrapped up in one guide for you. Find something for everyone on your list. And you can find that at picks.slate.com, picks.slate.
What is a pick? The NFL rule on the pick is very unclear.
Picks.slate.com. In 2015, Serena Williams won 3 Grand Slam titles and lost a total of 3 matches. She also made a triumphant return to Indian Wells, the tournament that she'd boycotted along with her sister since 2001 after unfounded allegations of Williams' sister's match-fixing led the crowd to turn on her in an ugly and racially motivated way. Scott Price laid all this out in a long feature in Sports Illustrated and an issue with Serena lounging on a throne under the banner Sports Person of the Year. Serena, though, did not win the online fan vote for Sports Person / Mammal of the Year. That honor went to American Pharoah, horse racing's first Triple Crown winner since the 70s. American Pharoah earned 47% of the votes compared to less than 1% for that woman who hits the ball. But even so, no horse riding person on the cover of SI, which made a lot of horse lovers very sad and angry. Writing on the website Horse Racing Nation, Steve Zipsy called it a sad announcement and concluded, Sports Illustrated, your agenda is showing. Okay. Joining us now is the kind of human embodiment of the Sports Illustrated agenda. It's Tim Layden. He wrote a story about American Pharoah in the Sports Person of the Year issue, honoring the horse with the Sports World's Achievement of the Year. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys.
you sound very sad.
No, I'm
downcast.
Not. I'm truly not. I'm 100% behind the choice of Serena. I would have been 100% behind Steph Curry or Jordan Spieth or American Pharoah. It's fine. It's an award that some people get in a room and talk about and decide, and they usually get it right in some way. It's fine.
I find it curious that of all the complainers, strangely silent, American Pharoah himself.
You know, he's had that quality about him throughout this entire Triple Crown run. He's a very, very silent champion in that way, and then we love that about him.
That is true.
Taking after Sunday silence, real quiet, just a real long line of stoic horses. So your piece and SI on American Pharoah was great. I mean, the pieces you've written about him throughout the Triple Crown run have been great, and a lot of people appreciated the fact and kind of understood, didn't take the sports man, person, horse of the year thing too seriously. But then, like, here are some comments on your piece. I just printed 6 copies of the cover of SI and lay them on my dog's cage floor. These are the comments on the piece about the horse. The internet was made for horses. Look through the pictures on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, etc. Your swimsuit pictures are eclipsed. I don't really know what that means. So
it's a horse award. the eclipse.
It is, yeah. I guess so. Why do you think fans, and I've, you know, read comments about this sort of thing from the horse people over many years, so I think it's fair to generalize. Why do you think that fans of horses and horse racing get so kind of, you know, angry, excited, exercised about, you know, when they feel like their sport isn't getting recognized?
It caught me. I expected a backlash a little bit. I mean, I knew about this. I mean, you don't do covers and stories in 2 days. I mean, this was some time in coming before the announcement. So I expected some blowback. It was much more vehement than I expected. And horse racing is a minor sport. Like most sports, you know, you separate out the NFL and college football, and then you go down from there to baseball and the NBA, and then everything else is sort of has its vertical audience, and most of them, I think, accept that position and enjoy the company of their like-minded fans. And I guess horse racing feels that they're either something more than that, or deserve something more than that, or that everyone who doesn't accord them that status is disrespective of their history and their place in the pantheon of sports. And I don't think I understood that until last week. I was disappointed that racing fans wanted to turn this against Serena Williams, which was unpleasant. And I was disappointed that they weren't able, at the end of December, after a great year for them, and probably one that won't be repeated anytime soon, couldn't just enjoy that. I was surprised. I think fans of luge or riflery or archery or any one of many other sports sort of understand what their place is and accept it.
There were some lugers that were absolutely overlooked for Sports Person of the Year, and I think you should convey that to your editors, Tim. It was a disgrace. The luge community is very upset. But the horse people have always had a tendency toward the ridiculous. When Barbaro died, there was poetry, and there were artwork was created, and there were Twitter feeds created. There's a strain of this in the horse community. I think that's part of that is they love these animals and they love the majesty of these animals, and they really do respect the beauty and grace and strength of these creatures, as do you and as do other sort of sane chroniclers of the sport. I mean, there's a lovely moment in your piece where you and American Pharoah shared an intimate moment in the stall. And I thought that was really beautiful. You were feeding him carrots.
An intimate moment in the stall.
There was some nuzzling. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tim.
No, there was. I mean, I had carrots. So it's, it's like there was motivation to be nuzzled there. But, I mean, to me, that part was, for the Barbaro thing, I mean, that horse was injured and eventually died. So I understand the whole, I mean, I'm not a horse person. I didn't ride horses. I'm not really one of those. I like writing about the sport. It's rich with stories. People have had great life experience, much more so than your average NFL wide receiver. And so, I mean, I like that part. I like writing about NFL wide receivers too, but horse racing does give you a canvas on which to write that is a lot of fun. The thing with that I wrote with being in the presence of the horse, to me that was just cool for me because he's a great athlete, and you can debate that, and I know people love to debate that, but that's the way I view it. He can run very fast for a long time. That's hard to do, but he can't express how he does that, and to me that's when you're hanging around, I kind of wish I could ask him, but I can't, of course, and that's a great canvas for jokes too, but. At the same time, I just found it sort of cool, just kind of wanted to say, how do you do this? But, can't do that, so I just kind of soak it in, and it was fun.
Give him another carrot.
Yeah, another carrot. Yeah.
For the record, I'm more than fine with the decision. I think it was a shame that Steve Harvey mistakenly put the crown on American Pharoah first and then had to put it on Serena. That was awkward. American Pharoah handled it well, like a true champion. My question, though, is about the internet poll. So when the editors are in the room, does that even come up? Is that just something that the guys on the website did and no one even mentioned what the poll is? Is it conveyed to the readers that this poll will be anything other than a poll? Like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has a poll that accounts for like 1 out of 1,000 votes, such that NWA got 0.4% of the fans' vote and they actually made it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and Yes got 16% of the fans' vote and they didn't. But there is like a tiny little bit of the fans' poll that factors in your decision. So what's the deal with the SI relationship with the reader poll online?
Yeah, I talked about this at the Sportsman event thing Tuesday with Ryan Hunt, who's the managing editor of SI. And the people on the .com side and the management side of .com regretted that they didn't make things a little more clear. They didn't know who they were dealing with. I didn't know who they were dealing with. I mean, I really didn't understand the fanaticism that was. You could vote many times, and I think many horse fans voted many, 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 many times. And
you think?
I wish we had. The precede to the poll said, this is a poll to express your preference, and SI editors will make their choice on such and such a date. I guess we should have put that in a bigger font, maybe, or something. Make it clear this was fun. This was just for fun. Let us know who you love, but we don't care. You know, a small number of editors are going to go into a room and have a discussion and make a decision here that's going to be based on many things other than simply performance, although obviously Serena's performance deserves it, but she also succeeds on many other levels.
Yeah, and there's a logic factor at work, too, and most readers obviously don't know how the sausage is made. I mean, to negotiate a... Josh is rolling his R's. That was not a horse joke, Josh. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Scott Price over the weekend, who Scott wrote the Serena Sports Person of the Year cover story. I mean, this thing takes months to negotiate and plan and keep silent and set up interviews that allowed him to have a tremendous amount of access to write this profile. And obviously the public doesn't get that when you do a poll like this, it's really just to get some traffic to the website.
I wrote the piece on Drew Brees when he was Sportsman of the Year in 2010, and I think I turned that in around November 15th, something like that. So, I mean, yeah, it's a long process, and sometimes the choice is apparent way, way before December.
So, I mean, I think the explanation here is that it's the combination of, like, the extreme passion and sometimes lack of logic that people have around sports and the extreme passion and sometimes lack of logic that people have around animals. And it's like the perfect combination of, like, I want to tell a quick story here about the most mail I've ever gotten for a story that I've written on Slate, which was right after Katrina, I went down to New Orleans. I wrote a series of pieces. That's where I'm from. It was like very emotionally taxing and difficult time for me and for a lot of people. And one of the pieces that I wrote, I was going around in a boat, on like an area where, you know, I used to drive to school every day. It was now like completely underwater. And I was with the National Guard, I think it was, and we're kind of going around. And this was, you know, maybe a week or a little after. And so they were still looking for people, but there weren't really any people to be found at that point, which in some ways is good, in some ways is incredibly terrible and sad. And so in the context of that, I've said that there aren't any signs of life, making it very clear that it's no signs of human life. Later in the piece, I refer to the fact that there's a cat that was seen, like, a, you know, and that is sad that this cat is in this situation, but I think we need to put that in the proper context. And I got literally hundreds and hundreds of emails from people saying, why did you not rescue the cat? Where is the cat so I can go and personally rescue it? And I got so angry about these emails, and I didn't get any, nobody wrote in to say anything about, like, man, that was really sad that all these people died. And so just the way that people think that animals are innocent creatures, they didn't do anything to get in this kind of situation. Maybe the people could have made different decisions. But I think people just look at animals and, like, put them on this, like, incredible
pedestal certain people do. And when you have this animal that's a really once-in-a-lifetime thing in a sport where this is a once-in-a-lifetime achievement in the sport, the horse people are like, when are the rest of you going to understand and appreciate like how special this is? And it's just like a slap in the face, a slap in a very long face. That's my spiel about animals.
No. There's lots of examples of this. The Michael Vick situation with with his dogs was extremely emotional for a lot of people because dogs were involved. The single tweet that I sent out during the Sochi Olympics that got the most response was a picture of some stray dogs by a security checkpoint. You know,
in horse racing,
people feel like they are not just fans of these horses; they feel like they are their caretakers, because if they don't, nobody else will, which isn't true. They have great caretakers in their daily life, but that's the way they feel. With American Pharoah, when he kept running after the Triple Crown, most people were holding their breath that he wouldn't get hurt, as much as being concerned that he would win. So you're absolutely right about all of that, and it enters into this entire response, and I just felt bad that people let it sully their experience from the entire year and that they drew Serena Williams into it, who can certainly take it because she's taken much worse, but she didn't deserve it.
Well, Tim, your piece was great, and I am not one of the people who wrote the anonymous comments calling SI a piece of garbage for not honoring American Pharoah. I appreciated it, and I took it in the spirit in which it was intended.
Well, I have nothing left to say about American Pharoah. I'm kind of glad he's retired in that respect.
All right, sir. Well, we'll have you back on soon to talk about Luge maybe next year.
Okay.
Tim Layden is a writer for Sports Illustrated. Now it is time for After Balls and just a brief bite-sized moment of respect for the Mount Union Purple Raiders, who won their 12th Division III football title, beating St. Thomas of Minnesota 49-35 in the Stag Bowl. And as one does when you read about the Mount Union Purple Raiders, you start thinking about colored Raiders. Colored Raiders are a thing. You've got your Purple Raiders. You've got the Texas Tech Red Raiders, mm-hmm. the Middle Tennessee Blue Raiders. They're actually, if you look at the Wikipedia list of college nicknames, they're more colored Raiders than plain Raiders. The plain Raiders are Wright State, Colgate, and Franklin University. Then for the colored Raiders, you have Mount Union Purple, Rutgers Newark Scarlet, Texas Tech Red, Shippensburg Red, Middle Tennessee Blue, Lindsey Wilson College Blue. But
Who the hell is Lindsey Wilson College?
Lindsey Wilson College Blue Raiders. So the only, maybe this isn't unique, but the only one I could find that seems to be unique as a colored Raider are the Ridley High School Green Raiders of Folsom, Pennsylvania. They're the only Green Raider I could find except for the Mount Union Environmental Club, which is also the Green Raiders. But Ridley High School Green Raiders, these after balls are for you. Folsom.
Because my mother is an alumna of Ridley Park High School.
Which is
just
not the Green Raiders?
Of Philadelphia. I don't know if that's the same. But not in Folsom, Pennsylvania. Different Raiders.
Mike, what is your Green Raider?
I just want to note that Lindsey Wilson College is named after the late stepson of Catherine Wilson. Okay. That's how they describe
it. That's helpful.
Stefan, what is your Green Raider?
So I was listening to the NFL. I rented a car, and it came with Sirius satellite radio and the good kind with Howard 100 on it. So I was really psyched. And I volunteered to pick my sister up at the airport because I could listen to all the NFL games. And I have to say, as much as we criticize the NFL announcing on TV, there is, I don't know if it's a level of professionalism, and just a lot of graphics to show and replays to show. So maybe it suppresses the amount of idiocy that the announcers could get into. Yeah, I'm going to say that's it, because they've hired a few guys that, if they were given the time and space that the radio allows for, would be as bad as the radio announcers. But radio announcing on football, I only listen to New York radio announcing. I listen to a lot of out-of-town announcers with baseball. There's so many more opportunities to do it. And even when I'm in other towns, I can't really think of too many times that I've been driving around in a car and really listening and paying attention to radio announcing on football. And it's bad. It's a bad state of affairs. There's this guy, Paul Allen. He does the Vikings broadcasts. He's not the billionaire, or maybe he is, and this is what he likes to do with his time. And he's like a little bit John Sterling-esque, and Randle with the sack. Seems weird on a football broadcast because all of the sounds of football, unlike every other sport, are mediated through a national broadcast, a voice meant for a national audience. The exception is your local broadcast when you listen to that game on radio. But I guess the flourishes or the things that are different from your local guys stand out more. But also, when your local guy is a homer, it doesn't strike you as much as when during the Colts Texans game, the Colts broadcasters are outwardly rooting for the Texans to miss this field goal to go up 16-10. I think the play-by-play man says, you know, they give the field goal kicker stats. He's 7-for-7. And the color guy opines, time for him to go 7-8. It just seems really, really weird. But the thing that stood out the most was that all the cliches of broadcasting are so prevalent. There's no one to say, maybe no national columnist to shame you, maybe no executive to say that's bad. Maybe they're just tenured with their job. And if they love their team enough and say things like, let's hope this guy misses a field goal, the fans like you so much, they'll protest when you leave. But it seems like every cliche is there, from too many men in the huddle. The announcer goes, how does that happen? Look, I understand that you're upset that it happens, but football's a complicated game. Have you noticed, except for the offensive line and the quarterback, the guys come in and out every play? It seems like the question with too many men in the huddle should be, how does that not happen much more often? All right, so that's one of the things. And then the other one, and this has been a huge pet peeve of mine, but it's not said as often on television, or maybe on television you can easily gainsay the assertion that every interception is going to be a pick six. And I heard that 3 times listening to NFL games on the radio. Oh, there was nothing but green in front of him. And if he had that, it would have gone the distance. People tend not to realize that even at the moment of interception, the other team can in fact close on you or chase an interceptor who is, you know, 10 yards behind the defense. That's it. Sirius Satellite Radio, an interesting prism into the football that we listen to.
Can we listen to Paul Allen's call of the Brett Favre interception in the NFC Championship game against the Saints? Oh, thank you.
Brett Favre goes back to pass. He pumps. Now he fires over the middle. Intercepted. I can't believe what I'm seeing right now. It was intercepted by Tracy Porter. Near side to the 40. And John Sullivan runs him down at the 47-yard line. You've got to be kidding me. I can't believe what I just saw.
Looking at that play, he should have just held on to it, Paul. He should have. He could have easily gotten 5 or 6 yards if he would have just pulled that thing down and dove forward.
But why do you even ponder passing? I mean, you can take a knee and try a 56-yard field goal. This is not Detroit, man. This is the Super Bowl.
Do you think that's why they drafted Christian Ponder, because of that phrase?
Why do you even ponder passing?
Here, let's listen to Steph. Let's listen to it. There is a Paul Allen soundboard. I'll just get Jared Allen sacked.
Rodgers back to pass, under duress, sacked! It's another safety, and it's Jared Allen!
There you go.
There we go. Stefan, what is your Green Raider?
Attentive Afterball listeners will recall that a few weeks ago I talked about the 1965 Hollywood screwball comedy classic John Goldfarb, Please Come Home, about erstwhile college football player John Goldfarb, who ran 95 yards the wrong direction, earning him the nickname Wrong Way Goldfarb. Would anyone like to hear that clip of Richard Crenna as Goldfarb and Shirley MacLaine as his reportorial nemesis one more time? Popular demand. Yeah.
Whatever you want.
Let's play it.
It's your journey.
Okay.
You know, we should be grateful. No one remembers Tom Goldfarb, but no one will ever forget Wrong Way.
Oh, you four-eyed cobra. I've been running away from that name all my life.
In the right direction, I hope.
Blow it out your teapot, iceberg. That's your nickname, isn't it?
You got an insolent mouth, Goldfarb.
Go play with your tripe writer.
This little boy, Noah. Let Mommy
give me
know.
That.
This is the State Department. You're in the wrong building.
As I mentioned, the storyline is based on the infamous 1929 Rose Bowl run by Cal defensive lineman Roy Wrongway Regals. He ran a Georgia Tech fumble 60-plus yards the wrong way before he was turned around by his own teammate and then gang-tackled by Tech on the Cal 1. I've also mentioned in other afterballs the football gadfly Matt Chaney, who trolls databases for old stories about the century-plus awareness and cover-up of brain injuries in the sport. Well, this past week, those worlds collided. Chaney sent his E-list news that could help explain why Roy Riegels ran the wrong way. Maybe he was concussed. In May 1928, Dr. Harrison Martland delivered his landmark paper linking boxing and punch drunk syndrome to the New York Academy of Medicine, and the paper was published in October in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Martland described, quote, a very definite brain injury due to single or repeated blows on the head or jaw, which cause multiple concussion hemorrhages in the deeper portions of the cerebrum. In the late stages, the symptoms often mimic those seen in diseases characterized by the Parkinsonian syndrome, end quote. Chaney tells me that in the months between Martland's study and the Rose Bowl on January 1st, 1929, quote, sports pages are full of punch-drunk allusions, such as describing a listless team or an individual's TBI on a football field, end quote. So after Riegels' run, it wasn't surprising that reporters would make the connection. The Associated Press reported that Riegels, quote, had taken a ferocious pounding on the Tech line plays, end quote. The AP reported that Riegels was removed from the game a few minutes after the safety, but returned to start the second half, and he was praised for coming back and playing well despite his blunder. The Portsmouth, Ohio Daily Times, which is one of the clips that that Matt Chaney sent around, ran the AP story under this headline. Georgia Tech wins national title by defeating California. Was Riegels punch drunk when he made that weird run? Reporters took their suspicions that Riegels was concussed to the locker room. The International News Service reported that Cal coach Clarence Nibbs Price took Riegels out of the game after the safety because he thought he was punch drunk. The coach apparently used those very words. The INS reported that Riegels, as athlete to this day are wont to do, denied that he was brain injured. Quote, Riegels, in describing his costly blunder, explained the play today as follows, the INS story said. I wasn't out of my head, and I hadn't been hit. I was spun around like a top. I guess I lost my brain in the meantime. In other words, wrong way Riegels was probably concussed. No word yet on whether wrong way Goldfarb also was concussed. He might have been, right? Again, plot line that the filmmakers chose to ignore. A lot of parallels with concussion, Josh. Josh, what's your Green Raider?
As listeners of this show might know, I've been guilty in the past of confusing the made-for-TV Superstars competition with the made-for-TV Battle of the Network Stars competition. Superstars was the thing in which athletes from various sports competed in various races and obstacle course type events to vie for the title of the world's best all-around athlete. The first six winners were pole vaulter Bob Segrin, soccer player Kyle Rote Jr., football player slash criminal defendant O.J. Simpson, soccer player Kyle Rote Jr., soccer player Kyle Rote Jr., and water skier Wayne Grimditch, which proves something, though I'm not yet sure what that something is. Battle of the Network Stars was a thing where Gabe Kaplan and Telly Savalas led teams of TV actors against each other, again in various races and obstacle course events, but also in Simon Says. Simon Says makes for great TV. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know until yesterday is that the power and the glory of Superstars and Battle of the Network Stars combined in a glorious one-off event, Celebrity Superstars, which aired on ABC in 1975. The competitors included singer Bill Withers, chicken impresario and compulsive gambler Kenny Rogers, fashion designer Oleg Cassini, Jaws author Peter Benchley, and inevitably George Plimpton, who inevitably finished second to last, just ahead of actor Clifton Davis, the star of the not long-running sitcom That's My Mama. The winner of Celebrity Superstars by just a single point was Joseph Stalin.
I remember watching That's My Mama.
The winner, Stefan, was Joseph Stalin. That is, a man who once played Joseph Stalin in a TV movie. He also played Lieutenant Colonel Frank Kilgore from Apocalypse Now, Major Frank Burns in MASH, Tom Hagen in The Godfather. Yes, it is Robert Duvall, who was propelled to victory in Celebrity Superstars by taking the top spots in tennis, swimming, and bicycling, and a second in the 100-yard dash behind Bill Use Me Withers. You want to guess how fast they ran 100 yards?
17.3 seconds.
Come on. This is Robert Duvall we're talking about.
27.3.
I took the over like you normally do.
Withers ran it in a blistering build. Use me, Withers. Ran it in 11.3.
Wow.
Duvall just behind at 11.33.
Wow. Fit. Robert Duvall. Must
also,
have been right after the apocalypse.
Wind dated.
also in that heat, coming in with a did not finish, was George Lindsay, a.k.a. Goober Pyle from the Andy Griffith Show. And now, what this after ball has been building up to.
So you're saying then, as in presidential politics, Lindsay dropped out. Okay, thank you.
What we've all been waiting for, Duvall's victory in Celebrity Superstars earned him a spot in the 76 regular superstars against actual athletes. In that competition, Duvall faced the immortal Kyle Rote Jr., three-time Superstars champion in the finals of tennis. According to a 1981 article in the Christian Science Monitor, Duvall started playing in the 1960s and approached tennis maniacally, spending 6 hours a day at it. It's like a great Santini-esque. So how did Duvall do against Kyle Rote Jr., who scored 42 goals in 121 appearances for the Dallas Tornado of the North American Soccer League? It was a match for the ages. The great Santini versus Kyle Rote Jr. Harry in Days of Thunder versus Kyle Rote Jr. Here is a clip of the legendary Keith Jackson calling the action.
The other surprise came when Robert Duvall, one of the fine actors in the world, failed to win the tennis. Now, he is one of the fine tennis players in Southern California in the amateur ranks, was outstanding in the celebrities competition as he won it last year. But he came up against Kyle Rote Jr. in the final, and having been very busy this winter, working in motion pictures and in the theater, Bob Duvall admitted that his concentration broke down. He got a little tired in the final match, and he wound up losing to Kyle Rote Jr. by a score of 6-4. But I must say, as Kyle Rote Sr. fretted in the shade under that Panama hat, that Kyle Rote Jr. played the best tennis in the match against Robert Duvall that I have ever seen him play in the Superstars competition. For example, watch this kind of shot making. He was just absolutely outstanding and beat Duvall by a score of 6-4 to take the first victory in the competition.
So I apologize for the scratchiness of that clip. The Library of Congress clearly needs to preserve the film of the 1976 Superstars competition. I also must say that there's really nothing worse than watching two people who aren't very good at tennis play tennis. You're not missing out on much, Stefan. Despite that disappointing defeat, Duvall came in a respectable 6th out of 15 in the Superstars final.
Who'd he beat?
Primarily due to his first place finish in bowling, which he won 189-180 over Kyle Rote Jr. Duvall finished ahead of such supposed athletes, quote unquote, as New York Knick Dave DeBuscher, Baseball Hall of Famer Mike Schmidt, Olympic decathlon gold medalist Rafer Johnson, nice showing Rafer, and bodybuilder slash Incredible Hulk Lou Ferrigno. Finishing in first place, say it with me.
Kyle Rote Jr. Four-peat.
No, this was one of the three.
That was one of the three?
It was one of the three. So they kicked him out of the Superstars competition because he won too much.
Two superstar,
Kyle Rote Jr. We would love your feedback on what we talked about today. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Please subscribe to Hang Up and listen on iTunes. You can find us by going to itunes.com/slatepodcasts. When you're there, leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Our intern is Christina Cody. Our producer is Zach Dinerstein. And the executive producer of Slate's podcasts is Andy Bowers. Hang Up and Listen is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening. I want to spread the news that if it feels it's good getting used, oh, you just keep on using me until you use me up.